for a six-pack of Miller Lite, a tin of Copenhagen Wintergreen for Kurt, and a couple of fudgesicles before heading down to the water. Once off the road, they sat licking the fudgesicles and drinking the first of their beers, while Dwight Yoakam finished singing Long White Cadillac on Outlaw Country. When the song, fudgesicles, and beers were finished, Kurt stuck a plug of Copenhagen under his tongue and said, "Let's get her done." Kurt got his gear from the truck bed and headed upstream from the bridge, while Hank believed that there were major catfish holes below the bridge piers, so he went that way. Both men were wearing LED headlights, the better to bait their hooks and unhook any catfish. Hank turned his light on to more easily mold some stink bait on a treble hook. He had his own homemade formula, concocted of chopped chicken liver, diced nightcrawlers, nacho cheese, canned corn, and cornmeal, thoroughly mixed in his girlfriend's wearing blender when she wasn't around, and suitably aged in the hot sunlight on his back porch, and threw his first cast out next to a pier. A big slab of gray stone shelved out of the river below the bridge, and while the bait sank into the hole, he walked back and forth, looking for a place to sit and smoke where his line wouldn't drag over the rock. He was doing that when he saw, in his headlight, a corner of the safe about a foot down in the water. For a moment, he couldn't believe what he was seeing. Then he called, "Hey, Kurt! Kurt, come here, quick!" Kurt caught the tone in his brother's voice, so he reeled in, turned on his headlight, walked down under the bridge and asked, "What?" Hank pointed to the water under the bridge. "Am I knuckin' futz, or is that a safe?" Kurt peered into the water, asked, "Where?" And then before Hank could reply, "Holy shit, I see it. That's a safe, all right." "Hank, what do you think?" "I think somebody couldn't open the son of a bitch and threw it off the bridge," Kurt said. He was so excited, he inadvertently hawked his whole plug of tobacco into the river. "Hank, like, it's stolen?" "Of course it's stolen, bonehead. If you owned a safe and wanted to get rid of it, you could sell it on Craigslist or even take it to a junkyard," Kurt said. "You wouldn't throw it off a fucking bridge. I bet there's $1 million in there." "What do you think we ought to do?" Kurt scratched his forehead for a moment, mulling it over, then said, "I think we fish that bitch out of there and get it back to your place. You know what? Maybe the people who stole it couldn't open it, but Jerry Pratt could." Jerry Pratt was an unemployed machinist with metal-cutting skills. "You think we could lift it?" "Somebody had to lift it over the bridge railing, so yeah, I think we could lift it," Kurt said. "I wonder why he threw it in the shallows. Probably didn't know any better. Or maybe he did it at night," Kurt said. He walked back to the shadow of the bridge, sat down, and started untying his boots. "Get your pants off." Hank looked around. Nothing to see but brush, and not even that if they turned off their LED headlights. An occasional car drove over the bridge out of sight. "What if somebody sees us?" "You ain't got that much to see," Kurt said. "That's not what I'm talking about. What if somebody sees us with the safe?" "We'll tell them that we thought it was an old refrigerator and we were taking it out for, you know, cleaning up the river reasons. We're like tree huggers or some fucking thing." "That sounded good." Hank nodded and said, "Better leave our shoes on. Lots of hooks been broke off in there." 5 minutes later, the naked brothers were chest deep in the river, trying to get a hold on the safe.
"Fucking heavy," Hank said.
"Yeah, but it's moving," Kurt said.
With more grunting and a few groans, they got it out of the water and up on the rock, where Hank said,
"Fuck, you know, it looks more like a refrigerator than a safe."
"Too heavy," Kurt said.
"It's a fucking refrigerator, man. Probably full of water."
The refrigerator was loosely wrapped with water-soaked duct tape to keep the door closed. Hank yanked the tape off, pulled open the door, and in the pooled light of their headlamps, Hamlet Simonian's left arm flopped out on the rock.
"Jesus Christ!"
Hank shouted, dancing away from the arm. There was a brief discussion of possible choices. Throw the refrigerator back in the river and then run and hide. Call the cops anonymously, then run and hide. Or just run and hide. But their truck had probably been seen up on the road, and somebody might have seen them in the water, and there was a house not far away. In the end, for a lack of reasonable alternatives, they called the Polk County Sheriff's Office and waited. A deputy showed up 10 minutes later, took a look, and said, "Now you boys wait right here." And Kurt asked, "We got any choice?" And the deputy said, "No." After that, the Yos found themselves deeper in bureaucracy than they'd ever been in the river. But nobody seemed to think they had anything to do with what was obviously a murder, and they were eventually told they were free to go. The Polk County medical examiner took one look at the body, still stuffed in the refrigerator, and moved it along to a better-equipped facility in St. Paul. Not much got done in St. Paul except that an assistant medical examiner took fingerprints from the hands on the severed arms and sent them off to the FBI. Virgil had gone back to bed at the hotel and was sleeping soundly when the BCA's duty officer called him at 5 a.m. Virgil crawled across the bed to the nightstand, where his phone was playing the first few bars of George Thorogood's Bad to the Bone. "This is Virgil. Hey, man, this is Clark up at the office. If I can find my pistol, I'm going to kill you," Virgil said. "Pretty unlikely scenario right there, you finding the gun. Anyway, I thought I'd better call. This Hamlet Simonian guy's been found. We got a call from the FBI. Virgil sat up. "Terrific. Where is he?" Clark said, "In the ME's office here in St. Paul." "What?" "Somebody killed him. They don't know how yet, and tried to stuff his body in a compact refrigerator. He didn't fit, so they cut off his arms and squeezed them in around the body." "Cut off his arms?" "Yeah. Of course, I'm assuming it wasn't a suicide." "Hey, Clark?" "Yeah, yeah. Anyway, the killer threw the refrigerator into the St. Croix up by Osceola," Clark said. "It landed in shallow water, and a couple of fishermen spotted it. They thought it was a safe." Clark told the rest of the story, which he found amusing, and finished by saying, "Now you got a murder." "Oh, shit. Give me the ME's number." As long as he had to be awake, Virgil thought the ME ought to be as well. He got hold of an assistant who said nothing would be done with the body until 8 o'clock. "I had a look at it while they were bringing it in. I don't see any obvious trauma, other than the dismembered arms, of course." "No gunshot wounds, nothing like that?" "Nope." "Tell the doc that the murder is related to the tiger theft," Virgil said. "I'll be up there to talk to him. But soon as he gets in, ask if there's some chemistry that would pick up the kind of sedative overdose you'd get if somebody shot you with a tranquilizer gun, the kind used on large animals." "Huh. I can tell you that kind of chemistry is routine, but I'll be sure to mention it. Could get some results back pretty quick." "Great, I'll be up." "Sounds like you've got an interesting case here," the assistant said. "Provocative, even," Virgil said. He reset the alarm clock, rolled over, and before he went back to sleep, he asked himself, who'd cut off a dead man's arms? Who'd even think of it? A medical doctor, maybe? He had to talk to Peck again. 2 hours later, while he was pulling on his socks, Virgil called the Polk County Sheriff's Office in Wisconsin and spoke to the sheriff, who'd been to the scene. "It's another one of your damn Twin Cities murders that you keep unloading on us," the sheriff said. "If he'd dropped the refrigerator 15 feet west, it'd technically be a Minnesota case, which it should be." "You're breaking my heart," Virgil said. "Yeah, sounds like it," the sheriff said. The sheriff told Virgil the story of the Yoder brothers and a description of the murder scene. "From eyeballing it, I'd say the guy hadn't been in the river long at all," the sheriff said. "I've seen any number of drownings, been down for anything from an hour to a couple of weeks, or even a couple of months. This guy was probably dumped earlier in the night. If the ME tells you different, he's wrong and I'm right. Virgil and the sheriff talked for a few more minutes, Virgil extracting as many details as the sheriff had. Then he hung up and drove across the cities to the BCA building. Clark, the duty officer, had gone home at 7 o'clock, and since he'd notified Virgil, the lead investigator, he hadn't bothered to leave a message for John Duncan, who freaked when Virgil showed up and told him about it. Cut off his arms? Cut off his arms! What have you done, Virgil? Duncan cried, rocking back in his office chair. I haven't done anything, Virgil said. Why do your cases always wind up like this? Duncan asked, running a hand through his hair. Why can't you have a straightforward missing tigers case? Duncan was only half joking. You know, most of my cases don't involve any violence at all, Virgil said. Most of them are really straightforward. I can't remember even one that was straightforward, Duncan said. What about the one with the spies? What about the one with the dog-napping one that turned into a triple murder or something and you arrested the school board? Are you kidding me? You arrested the school board? Not all of them, Virgil said. One of them is still on the run. Oh, man. Does the media know yet? I wouldn't be surprised, Virgil said. A Wisconsin County Sheriff's Office handled the case when the body was found. I expect they got the Simonian ID as soon as I did, and they know Simonian was wanted on the tiger theft. So they'll be calling. TV, radio, the whole shooting match, Duncan said. He looked at his office telephone as though it were a cockroach. I gotta talk to the director. That's not a good idea. He's gonna be a little testy right now. The director was about to be fired, if office rumors were true. Since the building contained a couple of dozen professional investigators and the usual garden-variety snoops, the rumors were generally accurate. No help for it, Duncan said about calling the director. I thought you liked being on TV, Virgil said. I do, most of the time, Duncan said. But I like it to be on the credit side of things, where I'm the hero, you know. I smile at the camera, show off my dimples. This is going to be debit. Big time debit. Good luck with it, Virgil said. You do have the cute dimples. Here's a tip. I'd stay away from the phrase, the suspect was disarmed. Virgil left Duncan to his media problem and drove to the medical examiner's office, a single-story gray building with all of the charm of a shoebox, built next to a Regents Hospital parking structure. The medical examiner, a chain-smoking doc named Nguyen Ran, asked, You want to see the body? No. What I want is some clue that'll get me to the killer and the tigers. Don't have any of those, Ran said. I also don't have any chemistry back yet and won't have until tomorrow, but I can tell you that you're probably right on the means of death. No sign of the normal types of violence, not even defensive wounds. But I did find a small bruise next to his left nipple. When I looked closer, I could see a point of penetration that would be consistent with a wound made by a big needle. I dissected that area and found a lacuna in the underlying muscle, and bruising that would be consistent with the violent injection of a substantial quantity of fluid, almost like an inch-long blister in the muscle. It's what I thought, Virgil said. He was shot with a tranquilizer gun. Yeah, I looked at his lungs. You don't need the details, but it all points toward a massive dose of a fast-acting sedative, big enough that the dose killed him. They didn't have to finish him off with any of the conventional methods. The cheesehead sent the whole refrigerator over. No tranquilizer dart inside. No dart was found at the scene. Anything else? Anything that would help me? Nope. Wearing a t-shirt and jeans, underwear, socks, and Nike brand shoes. No ID, no wallet or anything, no jewelry. Fingers were all intact, got a fine set of prints, about as good as you could hope for. What about the arms? Virgil asked. Were they cut off with a scalpel? Hacked off with an axe, anything I could look for? More like sawn off with a sharp knife. I'm thinking a butcher knife. Post-mortem, of course. No effort to carefully disarticulate the shoulders. They were cut right through. Nothing particularly neat about it. From what I get from my investigators, it was probably done because the killer couldn't fit the body in the refrigerator any other way. You wouldn't say off the top of your head that it was done by a doctor, somebody with a knowledge of human anatomy? No, the way it was done, a deer hunter could have done it. Anybody who'd ever taken apart a carcass. I mean, it wasn't sloppy, but it wasn't so skillfully done that I'd suspect a surgeon. You looking at a surgeon? No, Virgil said. Maybe at a regular doc. Ron shrugged. Couldn't prove it with me. Virgil sat in his truck and thought. If you had to hide a tiger skinning operation, you wouldn't do it in a tightly packed suburb. You'd probably want to do it where you had a piece of land around yourself, free of snoops, like out in the countryside. The closest big patches of rural countryside were on both sides of the St. Croix River, and Simonian had been found under a bridge over the St. Croix. And Peck had given him the name of a woman who processed animals in Wisconsin. Need to take a look at her, he thought. 14. Peck was lying in bed, listening to WCCO radio, when he heard the news. Hamlet Simonian had been pulled out of the St. Croix River. Oh, mother of God! He groaned to the thumbtack in the ceiling. He'd used the thumbtack for meditation exercises before he'd discovered the full efficacy of Xanax. With his luck, he thought, the thumbtack would come unglued some night and land point down on his eyeball. After a while, aloud, he said, "They found Hamlet. How could they find Hamlet?" He'd managed to keep his shit together during the interview with Flowers with the help of an extra tab of the Xanax. Drugs wouldn't help him with Hake Simonian, not after the bullshit he'd laid on the older brother. He'd told Hake that Hamlet Simonian was driving back to Glendale, California, where their family came from, where he planned to hide out until the heat dissipated. When Hake had later complained that he couldn't reach his brother on his cell phone, Peck had told him that Hamlet had turned it off, so the cops couldn't check his call history. He'd suggested that Hake go to the Apple Lost Phone Locator service and look for the phone's location. Hake had done that, and the phone was shown as being in Des Moines, and later moving west from Kansas City. Hake had been satisfied with that, and had gone back to work, drying out tiger meat. He'd planned to work most of the night, finishing the soft tissue part of processing Artur, and then he'd move on to grinding the bones. He was probably still asleep in the farmhouse. But Hake spent a lot of time listening to Minnesota public radio, and when the noon news came up, only one thing Peck could do about that. Peck went down to the garage and got the rifle out. Not the tranquilizer gun, but the .308 that Hamlet had used to shoot the male tiger. Peck didn't know a lot about guns, but he'd fired a few, knew how to load the rifle, knew how the safety worked. Guns were simple machines, and a child could operate them. Children often did, as illustrated by the accidental death statistics. He left the gun unloaded and worked the bolt a few times and pulled the trigger, getting the click of the firing pin, then slipped a .308 round into the chamber, put it in the Tahoe, and headed out to the farm. The Xanax was still at work. He was worried, even frightened, but functioning. In the run-up to his company's bankruptcy, he'd been handling the daily stress with Ambien at night to help him sleep, and Xanax during the day to smooth himself out. That had worked for a while. Then one night, while on Ambien and Xanax simultaneously, he'd had a couple of evening margaritas at a St. Paul bar, had gone outside, and had physically frozen on a street corner. For nearly half an hour, he'd been unable to pick up a foot to move. Since it was St. Paul, nobody had noticed. He might have stood there for a week if something in his brain hadn't finally broken loose and he found himself able to walk again. He had thrown the Ambien away but kept the Xanax, and now was rolling through the warm morning with a smooth chemical calm. He didn't think about the consequences of what he'd done with Hamlet Simonian or what he was planning to do with Hake Simonian, because the consequences were simply unthinkable. The Pecks were physicians. They did not go to prison. Were the Pecks psychopaths? He didn't think so. Sociopaths, probably, since he had to admit that he really didn't feel much for his fellow human beings. He even had a hard time figuring out what it would be like, feeling something for his fellow humans. His father, he thought, was probably the same way, since he hadn't apparently felt much for his wives or his only child. He didn't know about Pecks 4, 3, or 2, but his father had owned a photograph of Peck 1 standing next to a wagon load of severed legs, supposedly taken during the fighting at Cold Harbor in the Civil War. Peck 1 was leaning on the wagon, a cigar in his hands. He was smiling. Basically, Peck 6 thought, he was carrying out an old family tradition. At the farm, Hake was up and sitting on a stump outside the barn, smoking a cigarette, wearing a wife-beater shirt and jeans. He yawned, apparently just up. Peck parked and got the gun out of the back. The safety was off, so he kept his finger away from the trigger as he carried it toward the barn.
Gonna shoot the girl?
No, but you are, when the time comes, Peck said. I thought I better leave the rifle here. It makes me nervous having it around the house.
A lot of shit makes you nervous, Simonian said.
He yawned again.
Because I think ahead, Peck said. You should try it sometime.
How's the drying going?
Should be done by tomorrow, then we can start on the girl. The testicle slices came out good. You can start grinding and bottling if you want.
Probably tonight, Peck said. He could hear classical music coming from inside. Public radio.
You hear from Hamlet?
Simonian shook his head.
Nobody has. I called Mom, she hasn't heard a thing. You'd think he'd call from a payphone or something.
You tried to find a payphone lately? Peck asked.
There's that, Simonian said.
He stubbed the cigarette on the stump, then snapped the butt into the driveway.
Back to the salt mine.
Peck led the way inside, which stank from the electric dryers. The temperature in the place must have been over 100. Peck pulled the door shut behind them. A collection of bones lay on a blue plastic tarp on the floor and a pile of tiger meat on another tarp. Simonian had pulled all the teeth, and they lay on an improvised table along with pans of dried flesh. Still carrying the rifle, Peck bent over the table, looking at what amounted to tiger jerky.
Good, he said. You're doing good here. Anybody been snooping around?
The mailman stopped this morning. I was out by the road, and he asked if we were moving in. I told him no, we were getting the place ready to sell off. Probably take the buildings down. I told him we wouldn't be using the mailbox or getting mail, and he went away.
All right, Peck said.
He looked at the tiger meat, including the defleshed, toothless skull, and said, We'll grind up all the bones separately by type. Keep the femurs away from everything else. Anything we're not going to use, we can bury out back. You ought to use a hammer and break up the skull, but keep that separate. I'm not sure, but I suspect we'll get more for skull bones or brain pan bones. I'll ask old man Zhang about that.
How would anybody know if it was brain pan bones or leg bones after it's ground up?
Well, I would, Peck said.
There are some ethical standards involved here.
Simonian yawned and turned away from Peck to look at the bones, which was what Peck had been waiting for. He was 5 feet from the other man when Simonian turned. Peck lifted the rifle and shot him in the back.
Boom!
Again, the muzzle blast was deafening, and at the last second, Peck flinched, remembering the ricocheting bullet the first time the gun had been shot in the barn. He wasn't hit this time, though, and he looked on with interest as Simonian lurched away, one step, two, and reached out toward the remaining strip of tiger bone and meat hanging from the overhead hook, turned, and gave Peck a puzzled look, then fell face down on one of the blood-spattered tarps. Nothing dramatic happened. No last words, no struggle for life, scrabbling across the blood-stained floor. Peck looked at the suddenly deceased for a moment, then went to the barn door, pushed it open a crack, and looked out. The barn was set well back from the road, and nobody was on the road. So it was done. Peck had known from the start that he'd have to get rid of the Simonians, though he'd hoped it would be later than this. Now he'd have to finish processing the tiger meat on his own. As that thought occurred to him, he felt the prickling of hair on the back of his neck and turned to see Katya peering at him with her golden eyes. She seemed to be waiting. "What do you want?" Peck asked the cat. Katya stared back at him, unmoving, making no noise. A pan sat inside the cage, empty. They'd known they'd want to keep the female tiger alive for a few days until they were finished processing the male, so they'd provided a water pan. Hake apparently hadn't been filling it. A hose came in from outside. Hake had been using it to wash down the tiger carcass. And now Peck set the rifle aside and dragged the hose over to the cage, turned the nozzle on, and filled the pan through the fence. Katya didn't move. "It's there if you want it," Peck told her. He turned to the problem of getting rid of Hake's body. He could back the Tahoe up to the barn door and get the body out without being seen, but getting a 240-pound body into the truck would be a problem. Three of them had struggled to get the male tiger onto a 6-inch-high dolly when they'd only had to lift a bit more than 200 pounds each, and Hake had lifted a lot more than his share. Katya made a rumbling sound from her cage, and Peck glanced back at her. She hadn't eaten in 3 days, probably hungry. He turned back to the problem of moving Hake, and then thought, wait, a hungry tiger? He had 240 pounds of fresh meat. Hake was heavily built, especially from the waist down, and one of his legs probably weighed between 45 and 50 pounds, if he remembered his medical texts correctly. Removing the legs would seriously reduce the load, he thought, and all the tools for doing that were right here in the barn. Two birds with one stone. He looked at the cat. "Got the munchies?" Katya didn't say anything, but lay back and watched him. 15. Roberta Patterson lived out in the countryside, in a ranch-style house with yellow siding and an oversized mailbox, surrounded by dusty-looking cone flowers, out on the county road. She was getting her mail when Virgil pulled into her Hosta-lined driveway. Virgil knew a man who bred Hostas, but he was not confident of that man's intelligence. "Do I know you?" Patterson asked as he got out of his truck, stepping carefully to avoid the Hostas. "Nope, I'm a Minnesota cop looking for the tigers," Virgil said. "Ah, I wondered if you'd come around here," she said as she thumbed through the mail. "You got some ID?" Virgil showed her his ID, and they walked up the driveway to the house, talking about what a nice day it was and how last week's rain had kept down the dust after a dry summer. A metal garage or work building sat behind the main house and was nearly as large as the house. Patterson said, "That's where I work. I guess you know what I do." "Yeah, but I don't know exactly how you do it," Virgil said. "Come on inside. You want a root beer? I just bought some." "That'd be good," he said. "Scoop of vanilla ice cream? Yeah, that'd be great." They sat in her compact kitchen to talk. The kitchen smelled of country vegetables like carrots and onions, with just the barest undertone of soil and skunk. As Patterson put the root beer floats together, she said, "To keep it simple, I collect a variety of fauna and flora, animals and plants, and dry them and prepare them and bottle them and ship them to people who distribute them through traditional medical channels." She was a tall, thin, dark-haired, blue-eyed woman in her middle 40s. She was wearing a white blouse with a wolf's head embroidered into it, jeans, and hiking boots. "I get the animal parts through a local fur dealer, and some from roadkill. The plants I collect myself, usually from river bottoms, and I have a patch of ground I lease from a local farmer for growing marigolds and mint, and a bunch of other herbs." "You haven't heard anything about the tigers?" "No, of course not.
or I would have called the police, she said. She handed him the float in a ceramic mug. I'd never be involved with anything like that, or anything that involved endangered animals. The animals that I use are members of the weasel family. Mink, otters, martens, brought in by trappers. And I'll get striped skunks from the same place. Or from roadkill. They're all used for their musk. In the fall, I'll get bear gallbladders, which are collected for the bile. Animals are a relatively small part of the business. I do a ton of herbs. That's most of it. Do you know anybody who would have heard about the tigers? If there's anything out there to hear? Honestly, if there was anything to hear, it'd probably be me, Patterson said. There hasn't been a hint, so if the tigers were going to be used for medicine, I believe it has to be somebody working on his own. Or it's not people who are going to use them for medicine. There are animal rights people. Virgil spooned up a chunk of ice cream, ate it, and said, We haven't ruled that out, but there's a problem. One of the people who we strongly believe was involved was found murdered, dumped in the St. Croix, not far from here. The thing is, he was a professional criminal, a professional thief, not the kind of person you'd find hanging around with, radical do-gooders. Do you even know any radical do-gooders? She asked, with a tinge of skepticism. As a matter of fact, I do. I talked to a couple of them, and they say they haven't heard a thing. I believe them, Virgil said. Besides, they pointed out that the zoo is part of a project to save the Amur tiger from extinction. Even the most radical animal rights people would support that. All right, but here's the problem, Patterson said. Tiger parts are illegal in the U.S. and most of the rest of the world. They're even illegal in China, though the law is mostly ignored there. So you've got, say, 1,000 pounds of tiger that you need to distribute? How do you do that? To put it another way, since you're a police officer, how would somebody get rid of 1,000 pounds of cocaine or heroin? Virgil considered that for a moment, then said, You'd need a distribution network. Not just a distribution network, she said, an illegal distribution network. As illegal as a Mexican drug cartel. Everybody involved would be committing a felony. Hadn't thought about that part, Virgil said. Where would I find a network like that? Ask your drug people, she said. I suppose it'd be out on the West Coast, where you've got a lot of older Asian residents who'd be the main customers. Unless, of course, it's being shipped directly to China. Huh. I'd point out that somebody with access to a large illegal distribution network is not going to be a debutante. You said this man who was murdered was a professional criminal. That fits. Virgil asked, You have any idea of where I'd look? None at all, except what I see in the movies. Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, maybe. Vancouver, I guess. Jeez. He drank the last of the root beer. I wonder if they might have already moved the tigers out. She shrugged. Could have, I guess, although that'd be a problem. I have horses, and moving them around is a pain, even with a good horse trailer, when you're going any long distance. With tigers? Be a heck of a lot easier killing and processing them here. Once they're processed and the products get fake labels, who would know that they're looking at illegal tiger parts and not legal cattle parts? Ground-up bone looks like ground-up bone. You'd need a DNA test to tell the difference. Okay, Virgil said. He was at least semi-convinced. He took a business card from his pocket and slid it across the table to her. Thanks for your help. And the root beer float? Call me if you hear anything or think of anything else. She picked up the card. I will. I do hope you find these guys. They're the kind of people who give traditional medicine a bad name. Virgil headed back to the Twin Cities. He was crossing the St. Croix Bridge at Hudson when a call came in from an unknown number. When he answered, Patterson said, This is Bobby Patterson again. Listen, I did think of something else. It's possible that they killed the tigers and then froze them to take them somewhere else to process them. That involves refrigerated trucks. Keeping 1,000 pounds of meat at freezing temperatures isn't all that easy if you're moving. It'd be easier to buy some meat dryers and do it right here. They're not expensive. People use them to make deer jerky. They'd probably need 4 or 5 of the smaller dryers. I doubt that they'd buy a big commercial deal, so maybe you should call up the dealers of meat dryers, see if anybody delivered a whole bunch of them to the cities.
You are a very smart woman, Virgil said. Thank you. Virgil called Sandy, the BCA researcher, and got her started on that. Then called St. Paul's gang guy, who said he had no idea about Chinese gangs, though there were a couple of Hmong gangs.
I can guarantee they're not up to smuggling tiger parts, dried or not. These guys are hustling a little Mexican mud and hillbilly heroin. They wouldn't be involved in anything more sophisticated.
He said he'd call a guy in San Francisco and ask who'd know about Chinese gangs.
If you've got this dead guy from Glendale, it seems like you're looking at California. I don't know if my guy would know anything about L.A. gangs, but he might know another guy who'd know.
Virgil had just crossed into St. Paul when he took a call from another unknown number.
Virgil, Bob Roberts from Mankato PD.
Hey, Bob. You got my tigers?
No, man. Listen, I hate to be the guy to tell you this, but somebody beat up your girlfriend.
Virgil nearly drove off the highway.
What?
Frankie. She's hurt, man. She's on her way to the hospital. A couple guys jumped her outside a Quick Trip. Nobody knows why. There wasn't any argument or anything. They didn't even talk to her. They jumped her and beat her up and took off. Looks like it was a setup. One of the cops out there says they were wearing masks.
How bad? How bad is she?
Don't know yet, but she got smacked around pretty good. That's about all I know. I mean, she isn't going to die or anything, but she's beat up.
I'm coming, Virgil said.
16.
Virgil got south in a hurry, cutting through traffic with his lights and siren. On his way, he called John Duncan to tell him what happened. Duncan asked if he had any idea who'd attacked Frankie or why, and Virgil said that he didn't.
I've made a lot of people unhappy the last few years, but not many who'd know that I've been hanging out with Frankie, Virgil said. Or even if they knew, nobody who would go after her. Besides, nobody goes after a cop's girlfriend. If they're going to do anything, they go after the cop, and they don't do that very often.
Okay, I'll tell you what, Virgil. You go down there and do what you have to do and take care of Frankie and keep me informed, Duncan said. I don't want you investigating this. I want you to stay away from it.
What?
John, I've got to. You don't investigate attacks that might be aimed at you, Duncan said. I'll get Sands to pull somebody off another job to do it.
Sands was the BCA director.
He doesn't like me much, Virgil said.
Who cares? He's about to get fired, and his boss and his boss's boss both do like you. Even Sands can't say that we don't take care of our people, so I'll get somebody good, Duncan said.
Frankie had been taken to the emergency room at the Mayo Clinic, an orange brick building on Marsh Street. Virgil dumped his truck in the parking lot and hustled inside, where a nurse told him that Frankie was in the ICU.
That's temporary until we get test results back, she said.
How bad? Virgil asked.
How bad?
Don't really know yet, but not so bad, I think. She apparently lost consciousness for a while, back where the attack took place. That's what we were told, anyway. She was conscious when the ambulance got there, so she wasn't out for long, the nurse said. She was having trouble breathing when the paramedics got to her. We put her through a CAT scan. She had cracked ribs and a partially collapsed lung. The docs put in a chest tube and the lungs reinflated. Didn't see any brain damage, but she's got a mild concussion.
Man, that sounds bad. That sounds bad, man, Virgil said. He felt an urgent need to do something, anything, but there was nothing he could do.
It's never good, the nurse said.
He added, there's a lot worse comes through here every day and they walk out a few days later.
A cop was sitting in a plastic chair at the end of the emergency room, and he got up and walked over when he saw Virgil.
Hey, Virg, I talked to Donnie Carlson a minute ago, and he said they don't have any names yet, but Frankie took a piece out of the arm of one of the guys who jumped her.
Bit out a piece the size of a quarter, so when we get a name, we'll have DNA, and he's probably got a pretty good hole on his arm.
Virgil nodded.
Hang here for a minute, Al, will you?
I want to talk, but I want to go look at Frankie.
Sure.
With the nurse on his heels, Virgil went into the ICU, where the nurse opened a crack in the curtains around Frankie's bed. Frankie's eyes were closed, but when he stepped in, she must have heard the heels and his cowboy boots, and she asked, "Is that you?"
"Got here as fast as I could. What the hell happened?" Virgil asked.
Now her eyes opened.
"How shitty do I look?"
Virgil shook his head. "You look like somebody who got held down and sandpapered. No permanent damage, no big cuts or anything. You won't have scars, if that's what you're worried about." Her face was a massive bruise, and though her nose was straight and unsplinted, and so probably not broken, there was dried blood around her nostrils and at the corners of her mouth. He could see her bare arms, and they were scraped as badly as her face. Both eyes would be blackened for a while.
"That's what I was worried about," she said. Then she asked, "You okay?"
"What?" "Of course."
"I don't want you killing anybody," she said.
Virgil looked at her for a few seconds, then said, "I can't make any promises."
"Virgil!"
"Fuck you. I'm not making any promises." Virgil started to tear up, looking at her, wiped the tears away with the heels of his hands.
"Jesus, Frankie. We'll find the guys who did this. Have you pissed anybody off lately? Bad enough to do this? Unless you know somebody, it's got to be aimed at me."
"No. No, it wasn't." Her voice was quiet, almost rusty. "It's Sparkle. She wanted to visit a migrant trailer park on a farm out west of here. It's off a rutted dirt road. She borrowed my truck to get up there. I was driving her spec." Specs were cars that Frankie thought were too small to be useful.
"They thought I was her," she said.
"Oh, shit."
"They kept saying, 'You get your nose out of our business. Go home, bitch.'"
"There's a cop out in the emergency room, Al Foreman. You know him?"
"I know Al.
He says you bit a chunk out of one of them, and the cops picked it up," Virgil said. "The guy's gonna have a hole in his arm, and we can nail him with the DNA. We'll get him, I swear to God." Frankie said,
"That's nice. I feel really sleepy."
The nurse, who had trailed in behind Virgil, said, "You're filled up with painkillers, honey. You'll be sleeping a lot." They talked for a few more minutes, but Frankie was slipping into sleep, and when she was gone, Virgil kissed her on the forehead, backed out of the room, and found Foreman, the Mankato cop.
"What do you know?"
"Nothing but what I heard from the guys. She went over to the Quick Trip around 3 o'clock. She went inside and bought some groceries, and when she came back out, she was jumped by two guys who caught her between her car and a truck that was parked beside her," Foreman said. "Donnie can tell you how big they were and all that, but I can tell you that they parked in the street, so the cameras didn't get the license plate number. A witness says the vehicle was a red Ford Super Crew pickup, probably a couple years old."
"Get their faces on the video?"
"No. They wore ball caps without any brand markings, which means they must have bought them for this job, and rubber Halloween masks. Somebody says they were Mitt Romney masks. They wore canvas work gloves. The guys have the video down at the shop if you want to see it. Can't really see too much after the first few seconds because Frankie goes down between the cars. They were wearing work shirts and jeans."
"Do you..."
Virgil trailed away as a pretty but tough-looking blonde walked into the emergency room. She was tall, square-jawed, and wide-shouldered, with small, barely discernible boxer scars under both eyes. She wore dark slacks, a tan blouse under a dark blue jacket, and black, marginally fashionable boots that could be used to kick somebody to death. She said,
"Virgil, how's your friend? Is it Frankie?"
"Yeah, Frankie. She's pretty roughed up, but she'll be okay," Virgil said. He knew Katrin Mattson, but not well.
"Katrin, good to see you. This is Al Foreman, Mankato PD. Al, this is Katrin Mattson. She's with us at the BCA."
"Oh, yeah," Foreman said as they shook hands. Foreman said, "Oh, yeah," because he recognized the name.
Mattson had been a sheriff's deputy, famously kidnapped, raped, and beaten by an insane serial killer. She'd been rescued at the last minute by Lucas Davenport, and she had killed her captor with a steel bar, as Davenport had been reeling with a smashed nose. That was their story, anyway. Her ordeal and her resilience had brought her to the attention of the governor, who'd pressured the BCA into hiring her. Davenport had supported the appointment, having worked with Mattson on the serial killer case before she was kidnapped. She was building her own reputation at the BCA as someone not to be messed with, and who carried more than her own load. Foreman filled her in on the details of the attack, and Virgil told her what he'd gotten from Frankie, that the attack was probably aimed at Frankie's sister, Sparkle, and why that might be. Mattson listened closely, one fist on her hip. A full-sized black Beretta was clipped to her waistband just ahead of her fist. When they were finished, Mattson said, "Virgil, John wants you back on the Tigers. Soon as you can reasonably do it, he knows you've been making progress. Sandy said to tell you that she's found a shipment of meat dryers and has emailed the details to you. I'll find the guys who attacked Ms. Nobles." "Frankie," Virgil said. "Yeah, Frankie." "She's asleep. She's full of pain medication," Virgil said. "Okay, I'll be here overnight. I'll check every once in a while, see if she's awake," Mattson said. "In the meantime, I need to talk to this Sparkle. She's staying at Frankie's farm." "Why don't you wait here for a minute," Mattson said. "I want to talk to the doc. Then we'll go look at the video, see what the locals have, and then I'll follow you out to the farm. You better get back to the cities tonight. The Tigers are still number one on the media hit parade." She went off with the nurse to find the doc, and when she was out of earshot, Foreman said,
"Whoa."
Virgil looked after her and said, "Yeah." Foreman, "Hot and scary. I mean, totally jumpable, but then she'd probably eat your head like a black widow."
"I'm not sure I'd say that out loud," Virgil said.
"I hear you, brother. You okay with her on the case?"
"More than okay," Virgil said. And he was. Nobody at the BCA would go after Frankie's attacker harder than Mattson. He owed Duncan for that one. Mattson came back a few minutes later, and Virgil led the way across town to the Mankato Public Safety Department. Mattson had called ahead, and the Mankato detective, Donnie Carlson, had the video ready to run. "The store has a digital recorder tied to the cameras, and the whole thing is hooked up to the internet," he said. "We had the video a half hour after Ms. Nobles was attacked. Two cameras cover the gas pumps, a third one is mounted above the pumps and looks at the front door to catch a stick-up man coming out. We can see the attack on the edge of that one." They bent over the desk, watching the full-color video, which had no sound. It began as two men, one rangy and athletic-looking, the other too fat and built like a door, walked up to the side of the store and passed out of sight. The video then skipped forward 3 or 4 minutes to show Frankie walking out the door carrying a sack of groceries. As she turned down the slot between Sparkle's Mini and a truck, the two men jogged back into the video frame, then into the slot between the vehicles. Frankie saw them coming and turned at the last second as one of the men swung an open-handed slap at the side of her head. The slap connected, and she dropped the bag and flattened against the car, her hands going up to protect her face. Then the man hit her with a gloved fist, once, twice, and she tried to squeeze past him, but the second man, the heavy one, blocked her retreat and shoved her back to the first one. The athletic man swatted her across the forehead, and this time she began to sink down, and he grabbed her blouse with one hand and wound up to hit her again, but she turned her head and bit into a length of exposed arm above the work glove, and they could see him shout or scream as she wrenched her head away from the arm, and she fell out of sight. But the man kicked her twice and then ran out of the picture, followed by the fat man. Without sound, the video was flat and looked something like a puppet show. The punches and slaps didn't have the sound effects of movies. A few seconds after the attackers ran out of the picture, a third man hurried around the nose of the truck and looked at her, then turned and shouted to somebody out of sight and went to his knees over her, although the camera still couldn't see her. And they saw a heavy brown-haired woman in what appeared to be a hairstylist's nylon uniform run into the store and then a moment later two more men run out to where the third man was now standing over Frankie, shouting. One of the newcomers turned and ran back into the store. The video then skipped ahead to an ambulance arriving. The paramedics hurried up to the small crowd between the cars, and a moment later brought a backboard, and then loaded Frankie onto a gurney and wheeled her to the ambulance, and loaded her inside. A moment later, the ambulance was gone. Virgil hadn't really been aware that the two attackers had been wearing masks, and said so.
"It's hard to see," the Mankato cop said. "Watch this."
He typed in a number, and the video recording skipped back to the point where Frankie turned between the two vehicles and the two men appeared. Mattson muttered, "Watch out!" At that point in the attack, the men's heads were up and looking straight at the cameras. That lasted only for a second or two, but Carlson froze the photo as the two looked toward Frankie. With the image frozen, Virgil could see that they wore pale rubber masks.
"Don't think they look like Mitt Romney, but I've been told that's what they are," Virgil said.
"Yeah, they are," Carlson said. "We matched them with some masks you can buy from a Halloween place on the internet."
Mattson spent 5 minutes quizzing Carlson, with Virgil chipping in from time to time. Then Mattson closed her notebook and said to Virgil, "Let's go talk to this Sparkle person." Frankie's farm was northwest of Mankato, across the Minnesota River and out in the countryside, a 15-minute ride from the public safety department. Frankie's truck was parked on the side of the driveway past the house. Virgil parked, and Mattson pulled in beside him. And as they got out, Sparkle came out of the house. She was smiling, but when she saw Virgil's face, the smile fell away like a dead leaf off a tree.
"What, Virgil? What happened?"
Virgil told her, and she pressed her hands to the sides of her head and kept saying, "Oh my God, oh my God." When she'd recovered a bit, Sparkle said that she hadn't seen anyone following her that day, that her interviews had been congenial, but she had names of all the canning factory people she'd spoken to. Mattson took notes and asked more questions, and Virgil realized that he wouldn't be able to help much, wouldn't do anything that Mattson wasn't already doing. As Sparkle was answering questions, Frankie's youngest son, Sam, came walking up the driveway wearing his Cub Scout uniform, carrying a BB gun, and trailed by Honus the dog. Virgil went to meet him, and before he could say anything, Sam said,
"I finished second."
"In what?"
"Marksmanship," Sam said.
"How many people in the competition?" Virgil asked.
7 other ones."
"I should have won." He squinted just a bit and then asked, "What's wrong?"
"Ah, man, your mom got hurt," Virgil said. "Not real bad, but she's going to be in the hospital for a couple of days."
"What happened?" Virgil told him, and Sam said, "If I catch that motherfucker, I'll kill him." And he was deadly serious.
"No, no, the cops are taking care of that," Virgil said. "And don't say motherfucker.
You say it."
"Yeah."
Virgil slapped Sam on the shoulder and looked around and then said, "Basically, you're right. The guy's a motherfucker." Sparkle and Mattson were still talking when Virgil left, driving back to Mankato in the clinic. Sparkle said she'd come as soon as Mattson was finished with her. At the hospital, Frankie was soundly asleep, and a nurse said she'd be down for a few hours. He called Sparkle to tell her that, but Sparkle said, "I'm coming anyway. I called Bill, and he'll take the night off and stay here with the kids. I'll sit with Frankie until she wakes up, whenever that is." Virgil sat with Frankie for a while, signed on to the hospital Wi-Fi, and checked his email. Sandy, the researcher, had left a note that said 5 meat dryers had been shipped to an address in St. Paul's Frogtown from Bug Out Supplies, a St. Louis survivalist supplier. She left a link to a website, and when Virgil went to it, he found a red headline that said, "When the SHTF, BOSs got your back." Virgil figured out that SHTF meant shit hits the fan, a refrain he found throughout the online catalog. The dryers Sandy highlighted cost $231 each. She included the address to which they were sent, and the buyer's name, Bob Smith.
"Bob Smith," Virgil said to himself. "Right."
Sandy added a note. BOS said the order came in with a postal money order for the full amount. They said that's not uncommon with survivalist types. Apparently they don't want you to know that they're making survival jerky in the basement.
Virgil headed back north toward the cities as night was falling. As he did that, Winston Peck VI was driving the remnants of Hake Simonian out of the farm and onto a Washington County back road, heading south. He no longer much cared if the second Simonian's body was found. He'd been afraid of Hake, but now Hake was dead. Killing Hake wouldn't mean much in terms of penalties if the police ever figured out who'd killed Hamlet Simonian. His main objective was to get Hake's body well away from the farm. He drove south, slowly, not to attract the attention of any roaming cops, past small farms and orchards and truck gardens, crossed the bridge at Prescott, and drove into Wisconsin toward River Falls. After a couple of random turns, he found himself in the middle of a long, shallow valley with a wet, overgrown ditch on one side. With no headlights in view, he stopped the truck, dragged the Simonian load out of the back, wrapped in plastic, then staggered over to the ditch, waded into the weeds, and finally gave the body a heave.
That would do it, he thought. If somebody wanted to fish it out of there, good luck to him.
Virgil called Jenkins and Shrake. If you guys got the time, I got a target, he told Jenkins. We'll probably need Shrake to add a little IQ to the expedition.
Well, shoot, we were planning to go out drinking tonight and pick up some loose women, Jenkins said.
You can still do that as long as you don't shoot anybody while you're with me and get stuck with the paperwork, Virgil said.
Fine, Jenkins said. Where do you want to meet?
At the office. We won't be going far. When Virgil got to the office, the duty officer said,
Jenkins and Shrake are upstairs, but there are some guys looking for you. They're out in the parking lot in an RV.
I saw the RV, Virgil said. Who are they?
Don't know, the duty officer said. They came looking for you, said they needed to talk to the guy in charge of the tiger investigation. We told them you were on the way in.
Huh. Call Jenkins and Shrake. I'll take him with me, Virgil said. Jenkins and Shrake came down the stairs a minute later, dressed in their usual overly sharp suits, pastel dress shirts, Frenchy pointed shoes, and nylon neckties.
Where are we going? Jenkins asked.
First stop's out in the parking lot, Virgil said. Jenkins and Shrake flanked him as they walked out and down the slight hill to the RV. As they approached, Virgil could hear the engine running. At a lit back window, they could see four dark-haired men, apparently sitting at a table playing cards. Virgil knocked on the door. A minute later, the door popped open, and a swarthy, black-haired man in black slacks, a black t-shirt, and Frenchy pointed shoes, wearing a heavy gold chain around his neck, looked down at him.
You're this fucking Flowers?
That's
what they said you would have called,
the man said, nodding toward the BCA building.
Yeah, this is him, Shrake said.
Jenkins added,
Say, those are some nice-looking shoes.
Thank you. Yours are also attractive.
The man turned to the back of the RV and said,
This is the Flowers.
A moment later, six heavy-set men, all wearing gold chains, in t-shirts and slacks or black jeans, with muscles and ample guts, but no visible tattoos, dropped down out of the RV and lined up facing Virgil, Shrake, and Jenkins. Like the OK Corral, Virgil thought, except that he didn't have a gun.
You have information about the tigers? Virgil asked.
No, we know nothing about tigers,
the first man said.
Then what?
We are the Simonians,
he said.
We are here for Hamlet, to get justice for Hamlet.
17. Virgil looked at the six Simonians for a moment, then said,